Before you listen to this conversation with Adam Smeka, I wanted to draw your attention to a few things that he brings up. One, he talks about the Bank Secrecy Act of 1970. At the end of this video, I've linked our conversation about Natalie Smolinski's paper on this topic. Please take a look at that. It will help you understand a lot about how the legal system has made it more and more difficult for us to have good money. And it's gotten progressively worse since 1970. Second, Five Mile Farms is the operation that Adam gets his beef from that he gave to us as a gift on the show. Absolutely fantastic. Please check him out. I've linked him as well. Third, Adam is the guy on the ground doing this. I'm in a text group with him and he's asking people, hey, please go through your credit card account, see who you've done business with that uses a Square merchant. And I'll personally go to them and I will say, hey, do you realize if you switch over to Bitcoin, you don't have to pay fees, you don't get chargebacks, you can still get paid in cash if you want. Everyone's better off. He realized early on that if we don't spend Bitcoin in an economy, it will never become money. It'll just end up being like that shiny yellow rock called gold. And we don't want that. We know where that goes. So thank you so much for joining this conversation and listening. It's been a year since we started this podcast. Jeff Booth, Natalie Smolinski, incredible guests that we've had on here, and we've got even more coming for you. So please subscribe if you haven't already and enjoy this conversation with Adam Smeka. We are honored to have with us today our first in-studio guest. As you can tell by the awkward arrangement, we've done our best with our ramshackle, hackneyed studio here in order to squeeze in Mr. Adam Smeka. Adam, your ex-profile, Christian, father, and developer, Mana. You've created the Mana Bitcoin wallet, which has a bunch of other fun tricks and toys that's more than just a wallet. But whenever I listen to a podcast and I hear somebody give a biography of the person, I always think, well, they're probably missing out on what that person actually wants to say them about themselves. So if you would introduce to people, who is Adam? How you got into Bitcoin, kind of your journey, and I guess really what you're excited about as we're moving here into 2026.
Sure. Thank you so much. By the way, thank you guys for having me. I actually really like this setup. This is cool. I watch the show that you guys put on pretty regularly. And I've been watching you guys.
Yeah, you can see they got this is an apartment. You say studio kind of very generously, but this is a room in an apartment and we're doing our best. So thank you for that.
It's great. I think the mood, the atmosphere is awesome.
All right.
We've got the red light. Oh, I had the red light going.
So I think you mentioned this is your first in-person.
It is.
It is also my first in-person podcast interview. I've done, I don't even know, probably somewhere in the ballpark of 20 or 30 different podcast interviews over the course of my time in developing, but this is really cool to be doing it in person and get to
guaranteed that we're all wearing pants or that we've made an ironclad agreement not to.
No, we had to have a strict pants policy after kind of the, it is nice because when you are in person, it's much more organic to respond to people and to be able to interrupt somebody and interject and whatnot. So
I said something about sharing the room, sharing a space when we were doing the Nick Land one and Grant about told me to get out. It's like, I don't like
that. It's just jargon, right? I mean, let's share space. It's like psychological speak that's infiltrated, therapy speak that's kind of infiltrated into regular talk. So we got to be careful.
We cut you off.
That's all good. So back to the question. If I had to like describe myself, the underlying principle of me is, and I've probably recently kind of come into this idea or being able to put a name to this because of Bitcoin. And that would be that I consider myself a freedom maximalist first. So I'm a Bitcoin maximalist as well. But I'm a Bitcoin maximalist because I'm a freedom maximalist. And that's a core tenet of my life. As long as I can remember, you know, I've always wanted to help people be more free. And early on in my early adulthood, I thought that meant, joining the military. I joined the Air Force and I served in the Air Force for 6 years as a firefighter. And that's how I knew best how to help people be more free.
What 6 years was that? Was that some geopolitically fraught period?
It wasn't necessarily. It was 2011 to 2017. Mm-hmm. So there were some small conflicts in there, and you know, I ended up getting deployed in 2017 over in the Middle East, and that's actually when I found Bitcoin. So yeah. That's part of my Bitcoin journey. Is I was actually deployed and saving some money and trying to figure out how I wanted to preserve into the future and provide for my family. You know, as I'm, you know, I have a little bit extra time on my hands. And so I started investing into stocks. So I just got into the stock market, started doing as much research as I could. I didn't know anything in the beginning, but I was just doing lots and lots of research and seeing how people were investing and or trading. I hadn't figured all that out yet, but I was on that journey. And as I was doing all this searching on the internet and stuff, I was obviously, you know, giving up, you know, some of my tracking data to some of these advertisers that were then able to target me, which was actually my, you know, Bitcoin salvation, so to speak, because what happened was I got a targeted ad from Investopedia. It was an Ethereum article. So I found Ethereum before I ever found Bitcoin. And the article itself described proof of work. And so I started reading this article. And as I'm going through this article, it's just completely blowing my mind. I'm not even all the way, you know, probably even halfway through the article. And I'm like, this is one of the most important pieces of, you know, literature, if you want to call it that, that I've ever read. It was game changing to me. And before I even finished the article, I'm halfway around the other side of the world and I'm calling my brother on Skype. I don't even know what time it was in here. So it might have been like in the middle of the night. And I'm just like ringing. I'm like, dude, pick up, pick up. And he answers. And I'm like, I just read something that I think is going to change the world. And it was, of course, the concept of proof of work. I didn't know anything about, you know, anything else at this point. Again, I didn't even know about Bitcoin, which is crazy. I can't believe I hadn't heard of Bitcoin before this moment. But so this, again, was in 2017. And so that day I went home after my shift and I started doing just as much research as I could in a short amount of time. And I'm like, dude, I had to buy some of this. And, you know, so I sold all my stock, I bought Bitcoin, I bought Ethereum, and I bought Litecoin. And those were the three options available on Coinbase at the time in that journey. And so once I had those, I just kept doing more and more research over time and eventually got to the point where I became, you know, more or less a Bitcoin maximalist. But again, this kind of goes back into the theme of, you know, my passion, my goal is to ensure that people are free, that people remain free, that I remain free. And as a part of that, it's very important to me to make sure that I preserve other people's freedom too, because it's reciprocal. And without other people having freedom, then I am de facto less free myself.
So what about proof of work? Like, is it the technology? Is it, I mean, there's lots of like abstract ways to think about what proof of work is, like the real world reaching into cyberspace. And there's more technical kind of summaries of, but what about proof of work for you was like so groundbreaking?
Well, obviously, like you mentioned, proof of work is so, you know, expansive and in different disciplines and fields of study that you could look at it through like different lens that you could see proof of work and its impact and meaning. But in this moment, it was simply taking energy and converting it into a verifiable cryptographic proof that represents value. So essentially taking information from the analog world and translating it and bridging it into the digital world. That was the part that blew my mind, because I realized that has never been done before. And I spent a lot of time growing up. I was a big gamer, right? I played lots of video games. And so a lot of my experiences through the lens of, you know, virtual currencies and virtual economies in a digital space and seeing all the problems that come from, you know, game fiat, like in-game economies and in the fiat systems that run these things, even though they're not real money, so to speak. You know, I observed all of these things over time. And then I saw this new virtual money that could simply, you know, avoid all the pitfalls of somebody, you know, a developer being able to print money or control economy in a video game. And so, I saw this thing called proof of work. It explained, you know, essentially you're able to prove that the work had been done in the physical world, and then you could cryptographically prove on the digital side that work had, you know, been done. And then that becomes the underlying token. Of course, in this context, it was referring to this ETH token, but
yeah,
that is what I think was really pivotal to my understanding of what Bitcoin was and is.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, of course, you guys probably know, but in case anybody else doesn't, Ethereum is no longer proof of work. It is proof of stake coin. So that mind blowing or earth shattering moment that I had no longer applies to it anyway. So just wanted to make sure that was pointed out.
So this is a fairly esoteric, I would say, podcast where we go into, you know, a lot of hard to understand writings about Bitcoin or things that, honestly, be honest, very few people read, because a lot of people are just there for the time to grow up aspect of it. But for those people that hopefully find this that are a little less invested in that, they're coming from that world that you came from, where you were just trying to save some money. You're just trying to buy some stocks. You're doing some research. So what was influencing you then? Were you reading Warren Buffett's letters? Were you checking The Motley Fool? Like, what kind of an investment thesis did you have at the time? And has that changed? And the reason I ask is because I used to be a investment advisor. And so when I started, I was with Edward Jones, and the name of the game was diversification, you know, and diversification. Now I look at it as diversification is what you do when you don't know what to do, right? It's the thing that I'm going to sell the winners in order to pay for the losers. Yeah. And so kind of what was your investing thesis? And then how did that change when you came over and you saw what proof of work was?
It's a bit of a self-deprecating answer because it's a little embarrassing, but I was just a complete degenerate. So I was, of course, you know, I heard all of the good advice, you know, 60-40 portfolio and all that stuff. I didn't listen to any of that. I was looking for like the quick, you know, the quick fix, right? The stock that's going to, you know, rip overnight and I can get in and get out. I did have some stocks that I bought out of more of like an idealistic or like a from a moral perspective, right, too. Like just businesses that I wanted to support and become invested, have a vested interest in some of these businesses. And so I did that too. But again, my intent and the purpose was to get more money, right? Yeah. Because I was too naive to really understand how everything worked, and realize that the whole system's completely rigged against, you know, the small guy. But that's where I was at that time. And it wasn't until I found Bitcoin, and in fact, many years later, that I realized, you know, there's a different way of looking at things, specifically as it pertains to the economy as a whole. So a lot of people recognize this as kind of the dichotomy of Keynesian economics and Austrian economics. Now, obviously, there's a little more nuance to it than that, but more or less, you're probably going to idealistically fall into one of these two camps. And before Bitcoin, I wouldn't have had any idea that anything other than what I was taught and raised with, which was Keynesian economics, existed.
Mm-hmm.
So I never even heard the term Austrian economics. I didn't know any of the classical Austrian economists by name. I didn't understand. I will admit, my whole life, I went to business school too, by the way. So I was in all these classes and took all the finance classes and everything, all the economics classes. And I didn't know that what I was being taught was Keynesian economics.
Yeah.
I will say my entire education, I had trouble getting it to click for me because there were so many like little things that just didn't make sense. And no matter how many times I read them in a textbook, I could not piece it together. And it wasn't until long after I found Bitcoin that I realized it's because Keynesian economics is fundamentally flawed.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. I trained as an economist for 6 years and I never heard the term Austrian economics. I never heard anything about it. Nothing. You, in your article that we'll get to talk a little about here, you referenced, actually put in a nice big quote from The Creature from Jekyll Island.
Mm-hmm.
And I presume then that was your understanding of how like that really probably pulled back the wool, and seeing how Keynesian economics and modern monetary theory was flawed, which I think is fascinating because it was written way before Bitcoin was wrecked, right?
Exactly.
You know, and put this out and we're able to see, you know, step by step the process of not just how flawed it is, but how nefarious it was to begin with. Mm. But I think it's interesting to point this out because you're unique. Like very few people, I think, learn about Bitcoin because of proof of work.
Yeah.
Usually that's like eight steps right down the line, right? That's after the shitcoin casino.
Yeah.
That's after the NFTs. That's after all these other things. And then you finally come to Jesus. You know,
yeah,
you have your moment, right?
Right.
But yeah, so that book, when did you read that?
I want to say, I mean, it was probably coincidentally around like the COVID era.
Okay.
So I don't know, 2020, yeah, 2021 maybe, which is, you know, years past the time when I found Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So I would say I actually read The Creature from Jekyll Island after I started to figure some of this stuff out. But that book was extremely pivotal to my understanding of the economic environment just of Earth.
Right.
Yeah. So, it's an eye-opening book. And interestingly enough, that the quote that I put in there, I put that quote in there for a very specific purpose, and that was to argue the point of I'm rejecting the premise that Gresham's law must apply to Bitcoin, which is something that's pretty controversial because a lot of people like to point that out. They have this kind of this hesitation to spend Bitcoin, to use it as a currency. And it's a very common reason that people say it's because, well, it's Gresham's law, you know.
Yeah.
But if you actually dig into that and start asking them, you know, how that actually applies and why they're actually going down that path, it really starts to fall apart. And so I have a very strong opinion that Gresham's law doesn't apply to Bitcoin. And that's not to say that there aren't some good reasons to not spend Bitcoin if you know, you can convince yourself that that's the case. But a big part of what that article was about was basically convincing people that not spending Bitcoin is illogical.
Yeah. So in your article, you noted Gresham's law as a reason. You noted cost of transactions and things like that. Code of conduct, which is basically just never sell your Bitcoin. It's just kind of the ethos. And then the taxation issue. We were talking about this actually just before you got here. And Gresham's law, that's one of the ones I told you, like the class that I taught on this. We talked about that as well. Gresham's law. I was going to say, we should define it. Gresham's law says that bad money pushes out good. It means whenever you have a money that loses value or that has some other type of characteristic that is not going to hold value, the money that stores value will be hoarded and the money that loses value will be spent. And this began back in really since money ever existed, but with the Romans and coin clipping, and now it's been adopted with the fiat versus Bitcoin.
Yeah, because like if you have two coins and there is a emperor, an autocrat that says the face value of these two coins is the same, I'm going to accept that they're both worth one coin unit, but one of those coins is made of pure gold, the other one is gold and lead or something like that, then people are going to want to spend the gold and the lead coin because they're giving up less gold in each transaction, but it's been decreed from above that it's one unit of the coin. So the bad coin will circulate and the good coin will be hoarded, the gold coin, the pure gold.
I want to make something clear, though. I'm not rejecting Gresham's law.
Right, right.
No.
Gresham's law is a thing.
Don't think it applies to Bitcoin. And the reason I think it doesn't apply to Bitcoin is that it's not bad versus good because it was merely inconvenient versus convenient. That's what we have with fiat and Bitcoin. Before it was bad versus good, but now it's bad versus, near as we can tell, perfect. Like there may be flaws with Bitcoin, but there aren't any flaws that are greater than the flaws of the thing that they are replacing, is what I would say. But what's your take on that, I guess?
Well, my conclusion is that Gresham's law applies. And again, this is my opinion, but I believe that Gresham's law only applies because there is a difference in opportunity cost. So it is because under Gresham's law, or we could say we could go to the example of, you know, coinage in the United States in the last, you know, 100 years. We've seen this. We've witnessed this happen where we'll take the quarter, for example. They took the silver out of the quarter. Yep. And what happened? Guess what? Gresham's law happened, right?
Took the nickel out of the nickel.
Took the nickel out of the nickel. Right. So now you're in a situation where you could have two relatively identical, visibly, you know, coins, where one's solid silver and the other is an inferior alloy. Now, at the time when that happened, it's, you know, it's possible that both coins could have been close to the same value, but silver held its value better over time. And so over time, let's just say given a few years, now you have two 25-cent quarters. They're both 25 cents, but the value is different. So the cost is the same, but the value is different.
Yeah.
Right. So the opportunity cost, which would be, you know, how hard is it to get the silver coin versus how hard is it to get the inferior alloy coin? Those two things are different. And so that is where Gresham's law comes in. It's when you have one thing with one opportunity cost, one thing with another opportunity cost, and there's a third party that's imposing the value on it, right? So they're saying these are both worth the same,
yeah,
when we all know they're not,
mm-hmm,
right? So we're going to spend the one that we know.
Yeah.
We all know this one's junk. Yeah. We're going to get rid of that one.
Mm-hmm.
With Bitcoin, that's not the case, because you can spend, you know, 25 cents worth of Bitcoin for the same opportunity cost. You can spend 25 cents worth of fiat. Because of its fungibility, because of its, you know, ability to come in and out, because of the exchange, the fluid exchange of the assets, and the fact that you can continually adjust and divide,
yeah,
the amount of Bitcoin you need to be able to send to make that 25-cent payment. With a quarter, you would be forced to clip it or melt it down and recast, mm-hmm, maybe make a smaller quarter, 25 cents worth of silver. You can't extract 25 cents worth of silver from, you know, a quarter that's now worth a dollar in silver. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So anyway, that is my argument, or that is my explanation. And I've also kind of brought up the point that, you know, bad money drives out good money. That's not the definition of Gresham's law. That's just kind of how we all,
mm-hmm,
recognize it. That is a very common characteristic of what happens with Gresham's law. And I've also said it's kind of like gravity. We say what goes up must come down.
I saw the textbook. Yeah, 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 you don't, yeah, open the science and math books. Oh, there's an arrow down.
But if I'm talking to my, you know, my 5-year-old,
yeah,
you know, what is gravity, daddy? Well, it means, you know, when stuff goes up, it comes down, right?
Yeah.
That's a 5-year-old's definition of gravity. But we could probably all agree that there are things that do go up.
Yeah. It also just seems like Gresham's law is kind of like an ex post facto explanation of behavior that people already have. And so to say, I'm going to do something because of Gresham's law doesn't make sense. You're already doing the exchanges you're going to do because you perceive the values of the thing. And so you shouldn't say, oh, this other principle I just learned about, therefore I'm going to act that way. It's like, no, that principle is to explain a behavior that's already occurring. And we all know you can transact in Bitcoin in the way that you said, and it's fungible with fiat and it doesn't matter. So
the reason why I have such a chip on my shoulder about this is because it's so easily identifiable. And people say, when people bring up Gresham's law,
yeah,
I know it's because they haven't actually put any real understanding of their own into mm-hmm, the subject. They heard somebody say it and now they're applying it to,
yeah,
their behavior.
Yeah.
And that's why I have a problem with this, because people aren't thinking for themselves when they say it.
Nice. Yeah. You also had a really good line. This is, if I was a podcast host worth my salt, I'd read it. I forgot to take a note on it. Maybe you can repeat it off the cuff. It's like, you summarize it that the Gresham's law is when you have something in an inferior unit of the same kind or something like that. I wish I had that line. I don't have the article in front of me. It would be,
yeah, it's kind of like how I was describing the two different quarters.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So, and you just very pithily describe it in the article. And this is an article from 2023. We'll link to it, yeah, but it's worth the read because you do a very good job of, if it's hard to get mental traction on this, hearing it orally, your article does a good job laying it out too.
Thank you. And I think so. The one thing that was missing, and you did a good job recounting that, but the one thing that was missing was that there's an imposed, mm-hmm, value.
Yes.
Too. So, mm-hmm, you have one thing that's inferior, one thing that is superior, right, but there is a third party imposing value on it.
Yeah.
So those elements combined is essentially what makes it.
And that third party is always going to be the government that stipulates what the face value of the coinage is.
Yeah, or you know what, whoever's in control of telling you mm-hmm. the value is. It doesn't have to be a government. Yeah. But
it could be cattle. It can be a guy selling cattle and saying that cow is the same as that cow.
And so I guess if I had to like wrap everything up, just to hopefully stave off all of the trolls out there that are like, oh, this guy doesn't realize.
I hope we get some trolls.
Yeah.
Wait.
Gresham's law is absolutely, you know, it's a real thing. It's an economic law. And I believe that just natural, you know, human behavior generally always results in the same things we're seeing in Gresham's law. My argument is that that is something separate from what people are thinking they're talking about when they say they can't spend Bitcoin mm-hmm. for this reason. I'm okay with, you know, if you have a logical reason for not wanting to spend
Bitcoin,
we can talk about that. I can probably convince you otherwise. I've spent a long time doing that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that there's really no, once you actually work everything through and you talk everything out, if you're willing to actually go through that process of asking yourself the honest questions of, you know, is there a good reason for me not to spend Bitcoin? Or you could frame it, should I be spending fiat? Should I be spending Bitcoin? What is better for me? Right? You can start there. You don't even have to ask the question, what's better for Bitcoin? What's better for the central bankers? We don't need to even worry about that. You can just be completely selfish about it. Go down that path. You know, what is better for you? What's going to preserve your value the most? What's going to end up with you having the most sats on the other end of the table, or even dollars?
Yeah.
I don't even care if you're like just in this for the fiat money. Or fiat currency, it's not real money. But if you're in this for the fiat, like work down that path too. Like go through that series of logical steps.
Yeah.
To ask yourself, do I end up with more fiat at the end because I'm spending Bitcoin? And again, the another caveat to this is people will say, you know, never, this is the code of conduct part, right?
Yes.
Never spend your Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I think that that's actually a helpful thing to tell somebody that's new, especially somebody coming in from the ground level. They don't have much savings, you know, they're just trying to do the, you know, go through the motions and do the basics of accumulating Bitcoin, right? I think that that's perfectly fine framework to work from a new, you know, somebody that's new to this. But what is really important is that you are contributing to society through some method to increase, you know, the value and production of the economy, where you're being rewarded in such a way that is increasing your own purchasing power. And so to break that down or fill back even a little bit further, you know, what you're doing is you're making money, right? And you're saving some, and you're saving it in an asset that doesn't get arbitrarily inflated away from it.
Yeah.
So what is the goal? The goal is to save more than you spend. The second goal is to save in an asset that preserves its purchasing power the best, right? And if we can all agree that Bitcoin is going up forever in terms of fiat, we can round everything else down to zero or one, whatever you want to frame it, right? Because, you know, the volatility is, Michael Saylor would love to talk about.
Yeah.
You can abstract all of that out, right? Bitcoin's a bumpy ride in the short term. But over the long term, if you can agree or admit or believe that Bitcoin is going to beat the dollar over a long enough time frame, then my argument would be that all of your money should be Bitcoin.
So your positive case, though, for using Bitcoin as a medium of exchange, self-interested in a good way, where it's about accumulating value, keeping value, is that in your heart of hearts the reason that you spend Bitcoin on a day-to-day, for day-to-day purchases, or is there some ideological reason behind that? Like you say, you're for you personally. Yeah. You're a freedom maximalist.
Great question, by the way, because I think it maybe is a surprising answer. That is not why I have so much passion in doing what I do. The reason why I am so passionate about spending Bitcoin in the circular economy isn't necessarily, well, I guess in a roundabout way, going all the way around the circle, yes, it's about me, right? Mm-hmm. Because I want to raise my kids in a society that isn't controlled, where their every moment of their lives isn't controlled by a central banker, which I believe we have that right now, or at least historically speaking. I think we're transitioning away from that. But historically speaking, you know, central bankers have been at the root of controlling all aspects of our society. And it comes down to us in a very real way of losing our purchasing power, usually subconsciously. Most people aren't really aware of what's happening, but it manifests in so many bad behaviors that people, I guess, you know, have, right? Mm-hmm. So we call this high time preference behavior, where you're just making decisions because you can't, you don't have an asset. Like if you don't make this decision now, you're going to be penalized.
Yeah.
And that's your prioritizing that high time preference. And so, yes, it is selfish in such a way that I don't want that future. That's me. You know, I could care less about anything else. That's the world I want to live in, right? So we could start from that fundamental principle. With that said, I think in order to get to that point, in order to achieve that goal, it's important for everybody else to realize that same thing. And so right now, my goal is, and the low-hanging fruit, in my opinion, is to help show people that this is the logical path forward for them as well. Because if we can all agree on that, then, you know, my wish comes true. And hopefully at that point, I've convinced you that's your wish too. And, you know, we can all move further and further away from central bank control.
I mean, this is all Keynesian and modern monetary theory and the current environment that's dying. These are all political obstacles to Bitcoin. And all politics is local. And I truly, like, as you get older, you see that more and more, that truly all politics is local. And so if you want to change something at a grand level, you know, first start with yourself, and then you start with the circular economy around you in a way that, you know, if you show 100 people, they're going to show 100 people, they're going to show 100 people, et cetera, et cetera. So I really applaud that. I think that that's truly that boots on the ground, that bottoms up, that guerrilla type approach to building something.
But does someone then first have to have that ideology, though? Does it have to precede any sort of thing? You come at this first as a freedom maximalist. I mean, it shouldn't be this way, but it is the case that most Bitcoiners come at Bitcoin from kind of a libertarian angle, maybe first as degens, maybe first as something like that. But then those that kind of center around it maybe end up in the sort of libertarian camp. I don't think that is necessarily the case, but I guess I want to hear, like, is there an underlying ideological perspective that made you into a freedom maximalist that's more general or something like that, that undergirds your being a Bitcoin proponent?
I'm not sure if this answers your question, but I want to hit on some of the things that you said that made me think about something. But in terms of trying to communicate that message to other people, they don't necessarily have to come from the perspective of, you know, this ideological movement, right? Mm-hmm. I think that you can very clearly see benefits to taking steps in this direction. We see, Square, they just rolled out their Bitcoin purchases at their POS systems with their merchants. And, you know, they're offering, you know, elimination of their fees.
Yeah,
so
right
now there are zero fees if you do this with all of these transactions. There are no chargebacks. You get a pretty good amount of extra free market, essentially. And so it is not only just in this case, but in many of the other cases, many cases, it is the path of least resistance. Why is that? Well, there's no middleman. There's no bankers to pay. There's nobody, you know, there that needs to run the system and control us, right? Bitcoin is open. It controls itself, right? You know, we all contribute to it to keep it running. But at the end of the day, there's not one person that is able to flip the switch or make an arbitrary change that affects anybody without the rest of us going along with it.
Yeah. Right?
So again, the point I'm trying to make is I think that it is not just ideological, it is just
logical.
Yeah.
Not just ideological, but just also logical.
But the ideology, though, is there are people who want somebody at the switch, people who are comforted by a daddy, you know, who want a, you know, a governmental structure. They want the middleman. They want banks. They're going to...
These are only the people that grew up with somebody at the switch and they know no different.
Maybe that's the reason, but
yeah.
I think the ideological always precedes the logical. There is no purely logical is what I... is kind of my default.
Yeah, and again, I, this is the reason why I say... I go back to the phrase of the path of least resistance is because I think we're very clearly seeing exactly what you're talking about happening in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that result in? It results in more money printing, higher inflation, and this system that requires the more control, the system that is the path of more resistance.
Yes.
That one just gets further and further diverges from reality and from the other system. And it becomes more clear and more people become more aware. Adoption grows and people are going to naturally just start to wake up and see that their lives are being negatively affected. Like there's a tipping point for everybody. For the three of us here, we've probably reached that tipping point, right? We figured it out. Whatever that point was, maybe we were more sensitive to it, or maybe there was something going on in our lives at the time where we realized that, you know, we need to do something to change.
Yeah.
And we found Bitcoin. I think after speaking with, you know, lots and lots of people, even very recently, you know, I've been trying to find Square merchants just to help onboard them and offer my help. It's pretty incredible to see how many people I run into that identify the problems that they're having, and they have real reactions to this. You know, I'll start off by saying, you know, you can you pay 3% in your fees. They're like, yeah, that sucks. Like, yeah, that sucks, doesn't it? And like, what about chargebacks? Do you pay, you know, do you lose a lot of money on chargebacks? And people would just like roll their eyes and like, man, we lose so much money on chargebacks. And I'm like, you know, you can flip a switch to fix those, right? And I'm like, okay. And I start talking about Bitcoin. And that's like, a lot of times they're just like, maybe another time, come back another time, we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
It's like, it's, they can identify the problems, but they haven't experienced the pain enough to actually make this change, even though it takes them, you know, I think it probably realistically takes 2 to 3 minutes to go into your settings and set it up the way you want to set it up and enable Bitcoin
payments
with no other changes.
Yeah.
Because these people, at least the way Square has it set up, you can still receive the payment as fiat cash, US dollars.
Yeah.
So if you want to just take the cash and you get the benefit of the no transaction fees, you get the benefit of the no chargebacks, you can still get those things.
Yeah.
And it's almost no work. But it's the process of stepping out of the comfort zone that I think people have trouble with. And that kind of, I think, hits on your point.
Yeah, it does. And we were talking about that beforehand, too. Your article, 2023, it could definitely be updated with this merchants now being able to take the middleman out and that having a very real impact on their bottom line. But it's also, we were talking about this before we flipped the switch on record, your talk at the Kansas City Bitcoin Summit, that's what it was, you began in a very interesting way, I thought, where you led into Bitcoin by beginning with the very recent past and kind of a macro perspective of COVID, some of the things that had happened. And so that's what I think is really going to flip the bigger switch in people's mind. When you say like waking up, it's going to be not just the bottom line, but pulling people out of authoritarian structures they're very comfortable with and using as leverage things like, well, what happened during COVID? What happened with the Canadian truckers and things like that? And so your talk was just very effective. There's different ways to come at this. One is the bottom line, but one is I think you can dislodge people from that default framework they have of embracing the state, and you just did a good job at that.
Yeah, thank you. So I think the COVID era, looking at it retrospectively, was kind of like, I see it as like the soft launch of authoritarianism. It woke a lot of people up, and I think you're right. Events like this are gonna be waking people up. I think a lot of Bitcoiners were made during that time frame. In fact, that's when I, like before COVID, I would have considered myself a Bitcoiner. I would have probably even said I was a Bitcoin maximalist. But after that time period, I look back and, you know, in hindsight, I realized like there was still a lot I didn't understand. And it wasn't until it got really, really real for me because I was, like I said, I was a Bitcoiner, during that time frame. And so I kind of already had a lot of this mindset of, you know, this personal self-sovereignty that I felt like I was entitled to, you know, as a human, as an agent of this planet, and as just like, you know, a free spirit of God. And part of that is, you know, making sure that I can do the things that I feel like I need or want to do in a free country. I can't say that this was always the case, but at some point I was just like, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not playing this game, right? I'm not going to give up any more of my freedoms. And this was, you know, kind of a pretty serious moment for me. But during this time, as I'm coming to these conclusions and making these decisions, my fiat job, they came to me and they said, send me an email. And they said, you know, due to the Biden administration's, you know, rule or whatever, you're going to have to do certain things by a certain date or you will no longer be employed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm reading this and I, you know, this is my job, my career. I've been at this company at this point for, you know, over 10 years. And I'm reading this for maybe about 10 years. And I came to the conclusion that I was not going to comply.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not going to do it. And, you know, it wasn't about appeasing my employer with, you know, fake documents or something I saw people doing, stuff like that. It was more about, I'm going to take a stand, because if I don't take a stand now, then I might not have an opportunity or chance to do that in the future. And it is only because of Bitcoin that I felt like I could make that decision. If I didn't have Bitcoin in that, not just the financial cushion, but also from the fact, like, I knew that, like, I was seeing people get their bank accounts canceled, right?
Yeah.
Banks were, like, freezing people's funds during the COVID era because they were doing things that they didn't want them to do, right? It was complete draconian authoritarianism.
And not even doing things, saying things.
Saying things, yes. Saying things, being things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's a good point. Being, yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, again, so you had the, you know, obviously I had the component of like, well, they can't freeze my bank account so I can still spend money, but
nice.
Also the component of like the infrastructure, right? I at this point knew like, I could go buy gift cards with Bitcoin, right? If I wanted to, or I could go find somebody selling something for Bitcoin. And if I didn't have that Bitcoin backstop, I don't know what I would have done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cause I would have been in a very desperate situation. And so, you know, I took a bit of a tangent there, but get back onto the topic of the presentation at the summit, that was kind of, you know, where I came from, right? That was my, I guess the history that I had that led me to this path of trying to hopefully help people see things from the way that I see them now.
Yeah.
Because people helped me along the way when I was going through this. And I think that, like I said earlier, COVID was kind of like the soft launch of authoritarianism. I think there's more coming.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're going to be in the form of CBDCs. We talked about this. So my my thesis around the presentation was this progression of authoritarianism transitioning into CBDCs.
Yeah.
And how Bitcoin specifically used as a medium of exchange currency while preserving self-custody is the only way to stave off that pervasion of these centralized control technologies that give the government and authorities ultimate unilateral control over our very being.
Yeah.
So biographically, at this point, you renounce your job, you quit your employment. I mean, are you just totally just like nothing going on? Are you just like, I'm just going to, you know, what happens?
Well, I shouldn't have left you on such a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Let me get back to that. So I don't know. This is probably like maybe June-ish when they sent me the email.
Mm-hmm.
And they said by October 18th or something. I don't remember the specific date. That's just a rough time frame guess, but by October 19th, you gotta, you know, do all these things and comply, or we're gonna let you go. And so I'm just like, thinking and praying and talking with my wife and figuring out how we're going to do things. And anyway, it gets down to 2 weeks and then they pulled it. They pulled it. So I still have my job.
Nice. Okay.
Nice. So yeah, it's
Anyway, he stared stared down the barrel though.
Apparently I wasn't the only one that stood up.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is none of us were like talking about this. Uh-huh. We were all scared to death to like talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we were all just like independently like, we're just not doing it.
Yeah.
And it was pretty awesome to see that happen because we have like, so I've got like, you know, I work at like a corporate, a large corporate, mm-hmm. Conglomerate, but then we have our own, you know, independent, not really independent, but our own local, office. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at some point the monster wasn't able to control the, subordinates.
Yeah.
So they had it to the knee, which is
nice.
Cool.
Yeah.
I think that leads into something that I find to be an interesting inflection point that we're at right now, which is the fourth thing that you mentioned in your article is taxes. And you list out, you know, here's three things you can do. You can choose to not pay them. You don't recommend. You can never spend your Bitcoin. Maybe that's the thing that you can do. Oh, or you can just pay them, right? So it is kind of like this, that, or the other.
Also the idea of the currency swap, which you kind of talk about.
Swap, yeah.
There's that, but it's kind of a technical thing.
Yeah. But the when Steak and Shake started selling burgers for Bitcoin, I think it was like the day after Alex Gladstein from the Human Rights Foundation, he retweeted somebody posting their receipt and he said, this is how change will be made because you know none of these people are claiming that Bitcoin on their taxes. And so that comes in with the do not comply thing. And it's like, no, I bought a burger. I don't need to pay tax on my hamburger. And so much like your situation where you're faced with it at your corporate job, where it turns out that the subordinates who refuse to comply don't even need to peacefully come together if as long as there's enough of them. I think this is how change is made from the bottoms up. Yeah. Is that people will, and I know that we're not supposed to say, you know, you can't. Well, actually, you can. In this country, you're supposed to be allowed to say, no, you shouldn't pay your taxes because.
Well, you can't advocate it as a discrete act.
I'm sure you can.
No, you can't.
I can say whatever.
It is the official position of this podcast. You got to pay your taxes. I'll go on the record.
It's a great opinion to say, look, you're in a system where the thing that you're paying taxes on is a result of the value being extracted from you. Like, that's all.
If you want to be a political prisoner and go to prison, I'll support you, but
you're a political person. You're
I'll represent you. I think more so what Gladstein like practically is also saying is it's not even an act of conscious noncompliance at that point. People are just, if you enough people are paying, it's not even that I'm not like I'm not choosing to not pay my taxes. It's just like enough people are doing it. You forget about it. These exchanges happen. And then it's just like, oh man, enough people are not doing it. Let's legalize what is de facto occurring. Let's make it the new norm. Mm-hmm. So, but
here's what I'd say. And this is something I feel comfortable saying. I don't believe taxes are constitutional.
I don't either.
So I think they're infringement on our rights. And I also feel comfortable saying that I know for a fact that, like you said, like Gladstein pointed out, the authorities that are responsible for collecting taxes have no chance mm-hmm. against this movement.
Correct.
I think that that's going to lead to an inevitable conclusion that the administration, that I guarantee you, they're all sitting around a table having the same conversation.
Yeah.
They know they can't do anything about this.
Taken down by double burgers and tallow fries.
I love that.
Like, I mean, who'd have thought? Like, that's the bomb that gets dropped, yeah. Right? That takes it down.
But Steak and Shake, ending the IRS. I love it.
Yeah. and, you know, like, people forget we didn't have income tax in this country for a very, very long time. And when we did, this is one of the fun facts, like the game Monopoly was created partly with funding in order to get people used to the idea that you pay income tax. Like, this is what you do now. And they're like, wait a second. And I can only imagine what people in the 30s thought when this came out, because mm-hmm. income tax only started in the
teens or something like that.
13.
You know, 13. It was the
same year.
I think, yeah, it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, can you imagine, like, you're talking with your grandpa and he's like, income tax, you know, the guy that was, you know, operating in the 1880s. Like, why do I need income tax? And, you know, and then you have the same type of discussion. Why do I need a license to get married? Why do I need a license to drive a car? Why do I need a license to mow somebody's lawn or walk somebody's dog, to cut somebody's hair? That's a, you know, I hear Mark Andreessen talk about that on his podcast. I was like, look, like the amount of tuition that you have to pay in order to learn how to cut hair, how to cut hair is just insane. And so we just end up with all of these things stacking on top of one another. I agree that fundamentally there is a reason for tax, but that was to keep from being conquered. Hey, somebody's knocking at our door. They're going to tear your heads off and they're going to steal your chickens and they're going to rape your horses or whatever.
everybody
give us some gold and we'll pay an army and we'll beat them up and then we'll take them off. And then we end up in the situation that Eisenhower warned us against, which was like, look, this monster learned not only can it feed itself, it can make its own food. And so if it can make its own food and it has an insatiable appetite, then it's just going to keep printing money forever and ever. And it'll keep wars going forever and ever. And we'll never stop. You, by the way, we didn't say this. We should. Thank you for your service very much.
Yeah, thank you.
I tried to enlist in the Air Force. They wouldn't have me.
you pay your taxes, son. Well, I don't believe in taxes. Get out.
I've had too many broken ankles and legs.
That happened, yeah.
I just think.
But this is the point.
That waking up point.
Yeah, exactly. It takes waking up to move one ideologically out of a certain position. There are people who do vigorously endorse taxation, and they are our fellow citizens for explicitly redistributive purposes. They want a more egalitarian society. They see that as we need to take from the rich and give to the poor. We live in not a capitalist society, but a sort of kind of quasi-socialist society that just... It is a fact that many of our fellow citizens do believe that taxation is not only moral, but that it should be more at a higher level. And so I guess my only point is that, or maybe it's a question, to be a Bitcoiner, does one also have to ideologically be a freedom maximalist to such an extent that you think that taxation is theft, or does it inevitably lead one down that?
I think you could probably answer this with something else that I like to think about. And that is that recognize at least that there is one truth, right? That is the definition of truth. Right? There's only one of it. And I'm not saying that I possess the truth. I have my truth. Everybody has their own truth. But there is ultimately one truth. And because that's the case, I think that these other things do start to converge. And that's why you see Bitcoiners, you know, start going down this path of eating better and exercising and conducting their economic activity in a more beneficial way for themselves and the people around them. You see Bitcoiners just taking care of things with a more long-term focused mindset. And, you know, people like to make fun of Bitcoiners for this because they think oh, it's a cult. Well, the cult is really just a bunch of people realizing the truth about a bunch of different things. Bitcoin's a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that it's really just a convergence of a lot of different disciplines, fields, and areas that we spend time and effort and our energy in our lives converging to this centralized truth. Whatever that truth may be, I believe Bitcoin's a part of that because it is it is truth in a sense. It's truth money.
Yeah.
Right? You can't fake it like you can with fiat money. Fiat money is fake. It's fake.
Yeah.
It's not real, right? It's just an illusion. Right? It's not money. It's what the government has literally spoken into existence. You know, the word fiat, that's basically what that
order means. Yeah. Command.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I said so, basically.
Yeah.
Right? But Bitcoin is the opposite of that. It's organic. Mm-hmm. It became money. Because it just happened to possess all the qualities of a good money.
Yeah. What a historical moment to live at a time when something is becoming money because the thing that measures value is changing and it's going to have sociological ramifications that are going to, you talked about being a degen, you know, self-deprecatory approach or initiation to Bitcoin began as a degen. We talked about that kind of general. We talked about Brady Swenson's talk that he also gave at the Casey Bitcoin Summit. He talked about the fiat system, the way that it accounts for value also leads the way that we approach and consider time changes. In fact, leads to high time preference. Which one am I?
Time preference.
iPad.
Yes. Socialized impatience
it's
is
like
what.
Golf.
Yeah. Socialized impatience is the really good phrase that Swenson uses. It's not. Being a degen is not like an individual failing. It's a socialized failing. We all learn about this is how you have to act to survive in a society that's becoming a lottery.
It's so big right now.
Yes, exactly.
Everybody wants to strike it rich.
Yeah. And so it's just we're going to socialize ourselves into a new way of being as we interact with Bitcoin as it gains prevalence. And it's a very interesting time to be alive and see how that's going to play out.
The Bitcoin cult thing is interesting because it's making me think of something. We just got done talking about Nick Land's book, Xenosystems. And in it, he explains the cathedral. Are you familiar with Nick Land?
No.
Okay.
No.
So he explains the cathedral, which is
Curtis Yarvin's idea.
For
yeah.
The conglomeration of all the things that make up the illusion that we live under, the government, public relations, NGOs, all of these things that come together.
Media, academia, yeah. All the things that form public opinion.
All the things that come together and they say.
Is this a Bitcoin focus there?
Yes. Yes and no. Like, Nick Land is one of the most, probably the deepest thinkers about Bitcoin, but he's also, according to Grant, I'll point to Grant because he knows philosophy far better than me. Nick Land is one of, or at least in contention for being one of the greatest living philosophers.
I say that one of the greatest living public philosophers. He's outside of academia and doing philosophy on a level where it's getting a lot of traction among the public, which is a different type of philosophy. But
anyways, he talks about the cathedral and we bring up like Bitcoin as a cult. And when we view, when you can step back and you can view it as a cathedral and you can say, this is the great religion that's telling you what you need to believe in. And should you step out of bounds, then no, we shall smite you. Then it's very easy to look at Bitcoin as a cult because a cult is just a religion that you don't agree with. Yeah. Right. And so
it's the state religion saying here's a heresy.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 It's very heretical that you.
Right.
Exactly. And so that really strikes true to me. And to bang off of true that you're talking about, the greatest truth is the one that explains all else. It's the truth from which all the other truths spring. And so I think it's no wonder that when you find the truth of Bitcoin, that all of a sudden the glass shatters. Mm-hmm. And now you're looking at, oh, well, I have something to live for. I should take care of my body. I should take care of my relationships. I should take care of my spiritual relationship. I should take care of my house. You know, I should take care of my vehicle. I should walk my dog. I should do my hair. I should do all these things. And you look around and we give this, it is a negative connotation, obviously, to say degenerates, but these are not, as Grant points out, these are not degenerate people.
They are you and I. They are we.
People that have been pushed to
who we
edge.
Were. Yeah.
I'll say they're like, you're the subjects of the system.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
They're intentionally.
Yes.
Exactly. They're desperate, right?
They're socialized into it. They're acting as you would expect a rational agent to act given the nature of the system. And that's, they're taught to act that way.
And they're looking for hope.
Yeah.
As Saylor says, you know, hope.com, the coin is hope. It gives people hope to move in a different direction. One thing I wanted to ask you about it was the code of conduct one in your article. Mm-hmm. Never sell your Bitcoin, never spend your Bitcoin. They got Trump to say it, you know, Saylor said it. There's a caveat to that now, too, which is that you don't have to spend your Bitcoin. You can loan against it. You can borrow against it. We're kind of going through your article one by one on these four points, and we're saying, well, Gresham's Law doesn't apply. And the reason Gresham's Law doesn't apply is because there is no outside structure that is putting a value judgment upon Bitcoin. It's doing it itself. The people are doing it. Cost is not an issue. Cost is not an issue because you want to pay 3% on your credit card transactions and have chargebacks in a world where 3% is literally going to be for most retailers their profit margin. You know, if you're a grocery store, your profit margins are typically 1-2, right? So you could really revitalize the grocery store industry and maybe would have fewer, what do we call them, food deserts, right? So cost no longer an issue. Code of conduct, no longer an issue. Tax, we think that that's going to be taken care of from the ground up. So we went through your article. We knocked out all these things. None of those are a problem. What are the problems facing Bitcoin? Are there problems facing Bitcoin?
As far as spending it?
No. As far as Bitcoin becoming what we want it to become, which is the unit of account, the measure, the store of value,
medium of exchange. Yeah.
All of these things. What do you see standing in the way right now? Not necessarily as something that I think we would all agree that it's not going to be stopped. Like, you can slow it down. You can't stop it. But what do you think is the next big domino to fall?
Well, I'm actually really glad you asked that question, because I think this really kind of points to the whole reason why I do what I do. And I actually alluded to it in the article. I think I may have said that, like, there, I was maybe planning on writing follow-up mm-hmm. to it. I don't know if I mentioned this inside the article, so maybe you just happened to walk down the next progressive part of that path. But the next article I was going to write was about that exact topic, right? What are those things saying in our way? And kind of even reframing that, I was thinking about, but I haven't written the article yet. I might write it someday.
You're a good writer, by the way.
Yeah.
We read a lot of things. I feel confident in saying that it's a worthy compliment for me to say that you're a good writer. And I think you should write more.
Both on that article and on X too. Yeah, you just, really, because you have good, strong opinions, you need to back them up, and it's just refreshing.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, kind of a double-edged sword for me. I say, you know, what I think and feel. And, some people love that.
Yeah.
And some people absolutely hate it. Yeah. So anyway, back to the point is, I wanted to follow that article up with the explanation of why it's so important, why I feel so passionate about spending Bitcoin, and why I think that is a key component. And a lot of it comes down to infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what do we have? We have it's close to a perfect form of money that we could possibly conceive, at least as it relates or is comparable to other forms of money. And that's, of course, Bitcoin. And we have a really good system of preserving our value into the future. And I don't want to discredit that by any means, because I think that that is an absolutely critical component to make Bitcoin valuable, right? If it can't preserve its value into the future, we probably don't really need it. There's not much need for another, you know, currency that's not going to hold its value.
Yeah.
We got enough. And so it comes down to really kind of the three parts of or the three aspects of money, of how we view money. So, yes, it stores value. So it's got the store of value component. Obviously money needs to be a medium of exchange. Crazy enough, there are people out there that argue that, but in order, you know, for money to actually, you know, be money, you have to be able to exchange it with people, right? And then, of course, there's the unit of account, which also kind of even falls a little bit further off, because people say, you know, that comes later on, it's down the road. I don't want to get too much onto that, but my lane right now is medium of exchange. And that's so important to me, because I feel like it is the low-hanging fruit. And it's the one thing that's keeping us from moving into a Bitcoin standard, because we have Bitcoiners saying Gresham's law.
Yeah.
Bitcoiners saying, you never sell your Bitcoin.
Sold. Yeah.
You have Bitcoiners, you know, saying Bitcoin is capital, not currency. Mm-hmm. You know, when you do that, what you're doing is you're actually taking away, the value of Bitcoin, because if Bitcoin can't be used as a medium of exchange, my argument is that it's worth absolutely nothing. I think that it actually has to be a medium of exchange in order to be Bitcoin. Because if you can't send Bitcoin to anywhere in the world without permission from somebody else, it's not a medium of exchange and therefore has no value. That's what makes Bitcoin Bitcoin. That is what Bitcoin is. It's the ability to send value to anyone, anywhere, at any time, without permission from somebody else. So that's why I'm focused on the medium of exchange aspect. I think that there's a lot of room for growth. And that's why I talk about it, because I don't need to convince you that you should save your money into the future. That's obvious. And it's very easy to buy Bitcoin, even for the degens, right?
Yeah.
You buy Bitcoin to increase your purchasing power, right? Number go up. That marketing's taken care of. We don't need more marketing on number go up. I mean, it would hurt, but that's not, you know, there's not a lot of room for improvement on it. Again, I think the room for improvement is on the medium exchange side, because I think there's a lot of steps we can take to help show people that using Bitcoin as a medium exchange is a good idea. It's beneficial. And during that process, what we're doing is we're building out the circular economy, which is building out the infrastructure. So some practical ways to look at that are, I frame this question. It's like, you know, for people who don't want to spend their Bitcoin, right? Think about it this way. You're on the other side of that transaction. You do whatever you do. You're a barber. You are a janitor. You're a, you know, railroad worker. You're a doctor. You sell trinkets on Etsy. Do you want to accept US dollars? Or let me ask you this way. Would you accept absolutely KYC free Bitcoin from a Bitcoiner for your product or service? I don't think that there are any Bitcoiners out there that would say no. I mean, maybe there are, but probably few and far between. So frame it that way. Then put yourself on the other side, right? You need to enable that person to be able to have that opportunity, right? And that's the part that's like the ideological component that's not like intrinsically baked into all of us. That is how we build out the infrastructure. That is how we allow somebody to say, I accept Bitcoin, and put a Bitcoin sign out, you know, next to their kiosk, right? And then more Bitcoiners are going to come. And that is how this movement grows, and how Bitcoin becomes money. And in other words, how we reach hyper-Bitcoinization or a Bitcoin standard, however you want to frame that. It can't happen unless we're all using Bitcoin as a medium of exchange currency.
Yeah.
That is a necessary component to this next era. I think we're ready for that. We're still early, but I think we're primed and we're ripe for that movement into, you know, I would say from store value to medium of exchange. I do agree that the unit of account component comes later. I'm not a huge advocate for using Bitcoin as a unit of account if you really want to. There's nothing wrong with it. But from like a marketing perspective, it's very difficult. And, you know, obviously I have software and stuff, and I reach people, and I can tell you like that adds a lot of friction. So I'm perfectly fine with saying, hey, pay me $5 in Bitcoin. I think that's great. It also reminds people how much their fiat currency is losing value, because now you can say, all right, it's not $5 of Bitcoin, now it's $6.
Yep. That's nice.
$10. Yeah. Right. So it's subtly reminding people that the other side of that equation is falling.
Yeah.
Losing value. So, long
no, you are definitely a medium of exchange evangelist, like on all fronts, firing on all cylinders. I mean, you mentioned supporting the circular economy. You brought as a gift for us, this was very nice, this humble podcast, some ground beef that you bought with Bitcoin. And you mentioned the software you're doing. You have the Mana wallet enabling medium of exchange, KYC free and just simple to use. Your orange pilling merchants. One thing I want to know if this fits that you're writing articles about medium exchange. Another piece I wanted to know as far as the education, I think in the talk you mentioned you went to Africa. Was that part of that?
I didn't physically go to Africa. I've been an educator for a program called Bitcoin Safari TZ, TZ standing for Tanzania.
Yeah.
And so I've partnered up with them for a few of their courses. And hopefully we'll do more in the future too. But we've had a total of 3 cohorts, and I've been able to be a part of 2 of them. And so I teach Bitcoin using the Mi Premier Bitcoin. You may know about they also call it the My First Bitcoin program. It's based out of El Salvador. Mm-hmm. So we use that curriculum.
And what is that curriculum kind of oriented to get people using it like as a medium of exchange, or what's
that? I gotta be honest, it is all inclusive.
Yeah.
It is great. So if you haven't dove into that, even just no matter what level you are, I will say like it's taught me a lot, and I would consider myself pretty far down the line as far as my understanding of Bitcoin. But it was even challenging. It was a challenge for me as part of this education program to teach this to other people.
Cool.
So it challenged me to learn more. It's very well thought out and very well done, but it covers everything. I mean, the intent is to go into this course not knowing anything about Bitcoin or really being anywhere on the spectrum, but bringing you up to kind of almost an expert level, right? So somebody that's been in this space for a very long time and understands the intricacies of the economics of Bitcoin, mm-hmm. the technical aspects of Bitcoin, you know, using Bitcoin, of course, that's a very surface level thing, but I mean, it gets deep. Cool. It's really deep. So you go into all of the technical, I mean, by the time you're done with this course, you could essentially theoretically conceive Bitcoin from the ground up.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, the level that it's lodged at is somebody who is like high school or above kind of.
Let's see. Yeah. Yeah. Probably high school, college, mm-hmm. Adult.
Yeah.
It's for adults. Young kids probably, they may have a kid's version of the curriculum or something. Mm-hmm. I'm not 100% positive of that, but it's probably more of like an adult type oriented class.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Like the systematic ways to get a Bitcoin related education, because we kind of all come at it as a patchwork. Like you mentioned being onboarded by Investopedia articles about proof of work. And I kind of picked up random books, saw stuff on X. But there is that curriculum people can use. And the Resistance Money folks at the University of Wyoming, the Bitcoin Institute they have there, they have a public syllabus that's kind of like college student level, really holistic. The economics, the philosophy, the history, all that. So we're going to kind of, I think as we move forward, maybe get these systematized bodies of knowledge or ways to approach Bitcoin so that you get this holistic framing and it's not just like everybody passes through the same phases of shitcoining and then this and that and then kind of stumble into it.
Yeah. I think one thing to mention is like this course that we're talking about, it's free.
Yeah.
They don't charge anything for it. I know they do take donations. So, if you're the donating type, just shout out to them. They do a really good job. Bitcoin Safari TZ.
Cool.
On X. But educating like people in Eastern Africa, right? These are actually, in my opinion, some of the people that need Bitcoin the most. Yeah. Because their financial system is so fractured.
Yeah.
And you know, the problems that we're seeing here with, you know, our Federal Reserve in the United States, our central bank, is not even comparable to the amount of trouble that they're going through with their central banks. You know, some of these Eastern African countries, they're going through, you know, new financial regimes every few years. And Bitcoin to these people is a lot less on the, you know, capital side and more on the currency side, right? Mm-hmm. So people just need something that they can use to exchange value. And, you know, their first thought isn't, how do I save for retirement? You know, as maybe Gladstein may put, you know, that's our financial privilege, right? Mm-hmm. We can think about how we're going to retire and pass our, you know, inheritance down to our kids, you know.
Good problems to have.
Good problems to have.
Yeah.
But, you know, people like most of the people that I teach in these courses, they just want to be able to pay somebody for their food for that day.
Yeah.
And not have the government be able to steal from them.
Yeah.
It is really nice to see that side of things because we don't see that over here. We were joking earlier about, you know, how I had been approaching people to adopt Bitcoin, like Cash App merchant or Square merchants. And, you know, they acknowledge these problems and they kind of laugh them off, right? You know, these people in these other countries that are much less financially fortunate than us, this is very serious to them.
Yeah.
And they're very passionate about this. So if you haven't experienced, you know, looking at money and Bitcoin through the lens of, you know, one of these other places on earth, it doesn't have to be East Africa, it could be, you know, anywhere. I would really encourage people to maybe just read Alex Glassing's book. That's probably a good place to start and following him. It really does change you.
Yeah.
In Africa, one of the books that we read early on, there was an article in that paper.
National security and something, 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 Bitcoin, something. Yeah.
I don't know where it is. Digital money in the, I can't remember. But
anyways,
a guy lays it out. Former diplomat who had spent most of his career in Africa.
It's a nice collection.
Yeah. We got the Bitcoin bookshelf coming up here. This Annie, who you met, she makes Bitcoin-related art and other art, too. You got this B. It's classy. So, yeah.
Puts that stuff
does she have a website?
Etsy. She does. She's an Etsy person. Yeah. If you want some Bitcoin stuff, she's thinking about some new ways to do it. Maybe a matte black behind it. Kind of. Yeah. But, yeah, it's pretty cool.
But anyway, he noted, like,
Can't remember the guy's name right now. It's failing me. But anyways, he noted that Africa, in his belief, is that's the battlement. It's the youngest continent by far. So they have the most upward mobility in terms of being able to grow their workforce into something useful. Whether or not AI takes care of that is another thing, but also hugely rich nation in terms of natural resources and stuff. But there is a battle going on right now between the US and China. China trying to export turnkey autocracy to Africa,
right,
in order to eventually get, you know, military bases on the west side of Africa. And as he put it in his paper, you know, you're fighting someone who's exporting a nearly perfect system of turnkey autocracy. You don't fight that with a lesser version of autocracy. You have to fight that with maximal freedom. And so you have to fight that with Bitcoin, because that right now is the thing that's standing in between us and China.
Another interesting part about his paper too, like as far as Bitcoin in Africa, was the ethos of Africa being community village oriented and how that informs the growth of the Bitcoin protocol over there. He talks about Fediment as a kind of community oriented around a community bank model on the second layer for using, creating like you mint a currency within the Fediment or something like that. And I don't know perfectly how it operates, but it's just interesting how regionally people's like the different ways that they have organized in their society will be differentiated ways that they interact with Bitcoin on second layer protocols, how they're comfortable using and transacting, you know, using the value. So,
yeah, I'm probably going to get skinned alive for saying this because I'm, you guys might see, but I think the like Fediments and just federated systems and eCash and that sort of thing, it reminds me of a lot of wildcat banking, mm-hmm, in the US. And I think that that's going to be, that's going to be a huge part of our future. I do think that we're really early in that. But I have so many like high aspirations for what the possibilities are for that, mm-hmm, to become. And again, you know, maybe not the best use case for everything, but for very specific cases, right now it's already solving a lot of problems. You know, I saw on a video, this was probably maybe almost a year and a half, old, of somebody in some country in Africa. I forget exactly which country it was, but you could tell that it was they were not up to, you know, the standards of, you know, local, you know, McDonald's here in the, yeah, United States, right? We're talking like, you know, dirt floor, you know, no walls, right? This is just such a hut and, you know, a very destitute area. And it's a kid, and he's buying little donuts for like, I think it was like 5 sats each, 5 satoshis per donut. And they were using eCash to do it. And that's a case where, you know, eCash is needed. It's necessary because, you know, otherwise you're relying on a centralized custodial Lightning wallet, right? I mean, even Mana isn't suited to make 5 sat transactions right now very easily. You know, it's great for buying a coffee and for doing a lot of things that we use money for here and this country, wherever this, yeah, was. If you're buying, you know, a donut that's essentially, you know, worth less than a penny, mm-hmm, right? That's, you know, a very good use case for eCash.
Yeah.
Or it's, I would say.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's awesome.
I think one of the things we talked about earlier was the way that to onboard people, the thing that's drawing them right now to using like flipping the switch on Square so that they can receive Bitcoin payments is just that, oh, it's cheaper, right? It's 3%. They don't take anything away. You don't get the chargebacks. But, you know, I think in sales, I've worked in sales for most of my life, selling on cheaper is never a good option, right? Because the other guy always comes cheaper. And you can see, you can foresee a scenario where there's a CBDC and they're like, oh, well, CBDC's here. It's 0% transactions, you know? So that's not the way it's, but I think the thing that's in the Mana wallet that I have shown other people as like, this is the thing that really sets it apart to me, And this goes along with an interview that we did early on with Ivan Makadonsky, who's the chief of staff of Breeze, which is a lightning.
Yeah, got it.
Right?
Yeah.
And he had written a series of articles justifying his belief why split payments is the ultimate killer feature of Bitcoin. And I had thought about this. Your Mana wallet allows me to, and I'm going to use it, by the way, tomorrow at our Christmas party.
It's also the official wallet of the podcast.
It is now. So. It is now.
That was easy.
Yeah, yeah, it was like that.
We'll hold you up on the way out. But, you know, it allows me to very easily create a point of sale system, put my items in there, and not just put my items in there, but I can put your items, his items, her items, and they can each go to the individual addresses. And this to me, Ivan's the one that really got me thinking about this, but this is where we all become owners. This is where we all become, instead of the restaurant that is owned by the guy who wanted to start a restaurant and they start out as the cook and then they had to hire an accountant and they had to hire somebody to wait and they had to hire somebody to do dishes and they had to hire security, et cetera, the plumber, everything else. Now you've got the guy who wants to be a chef and they can be back there in the kitchen. And when the bill comes, they pay their bill and this amount goes to the chef and this amount goes to the waitress and this amount goes to the person that bakes the pie. And this amount goes to the guy that owns the building. And this amount goes to the accountant that does it. And so it allows us to seamlessly split all of this in, I hate this word now because it's been so abused, but in an equitable way.
Yeah.
Right? Where we're all getting paid for what we contributed. You've convinced me, by the way, through the course of the conversation, that the means of exchange is the manner in which Bitcoin becomes everything that we want it to be, that it has to be that way. We cannot get to a unit of account. We cannot get, we won't even get to a long-term store of value because it'll just be hoarded and it'll be hoarded and then it'll be centralized, right? And so, I think you're absolutely right that it's the means of exchange, but I don't think it's through the lower fees. I think it's through the interoperability of being able to split and divide these payments amongst people. That, and credit to Ivan for bringing this up and to you for building the thing, which is, it's so easy to use. It's so incredible. Your daughter is the one who showed it to me and explained it to me.
She's nine.
She's nine. So we're talking about like, oh, you know, this... you probably need to be high school age. Like, no. There's a 9-year-old out here explaining to people how in 30 seconds you can set up your own point of sale system. You can receive sats. You can get them free of charge. Nobody's taking anything out of it. They go direct into your wallet. And not only that, you're baking pies, he's making bread, and I'm frying up steaks, and we can all get paid for the meal equal to what we contributed. You know, so it's absolutely that to me, by the way, that's my favorite part of Mana. That's awesome. That is the coolest thing that I think you built in. You don't need Square.
I love to get it.
Yeah. You can have Square, but you don't need it.
Yeah. Square's great. It has a lot of things that Mana doesn't have, but not everybody can use Square. Not everybody has Square. And if you don't have Square, Mana is a really good option. I'm glad you said that because that makes me feel really good because I think that is our most underused part of our app. Yeah, people are using it, but I think it's in terms of how much value you can get out of something, there's just not enough people using it. I don't want to like over exaggerate things here. It's simple. It's fairly feature rich. We've got taxes, we've got tips. You can add your own custom fees. We have receipts baked into the Lightning, the invoice memo. You can put your pictures in there. You can, you know, do receipts, tallying. So it is capable, but it is very simple, right? So if you're, you know, a large franchise business right now, I mean, I think we're going to get to that point at some point. But right now, man, it's great for like a small mom and pop shop. That's like the sweet spot right now, like a farmer's market type thing, or you've got like a little kiosk or stand or something where you sell stuff, or you're a barber, yeah. Or you're, you know, you have a, we have
Well, musician.
Yeah, artist. Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, that's the, yeah.
Chiropractor. We have, you know, I know a chiropractor, doctor, you know, offering services that way. Some of our customers are also, I say customers. We don't have customers, just people who use our user software.
Of your cool, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't make a hammer and then say this is a customer of my hammer.
they're these businesses, these merchants, whatever they, you know, they are, food trucks. Anyway, just kind of going over since you pointed that out. Yeah. Not a lot of people realize that powerful tool is baked into this wallet. And there should definitely be more people using it, in my opinion. Which, by the way, shout out to Square and the Block and Spiral team. They actually featured Mana on their website. So, yeah.
Dude. No way.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah, that is really cool.
Well, okay, so I want to ask this. So Mana, I want to ask about the growth that Mana is experiencing, because the reason because the other day I looked up, what is the growth of the transaction networks like MasterCard and Visa and Lightning.
Mm-hmm.
MasterCard and Visa, they grew about 11-12% this year, which that's just literally the inflation. Like prices went up that much. Yeah. So that's how much their transaction throughput went up. Lightning went up 200%. What kind of growth are you experiencing with Mana Wallet?
Keep talking. I'll get my numbers.
Here's a question, though, that I think is
really interested in this.
And I have a question that builds into this one, just tying it all biographically. When do you start working on Mana in relation to kind of your Bitcoin journey and things that happened in COVID and then building, crescendoing into this business taking off?
Okay, sorry. I wanted to get this number. We're growing right now like 572% month over month. Yeah. So it's
pretty over pretty good. That was worth it. That was worth it.
Yeah.
I mean, we're still really small.
Right.
But so a lot of growth early on, but
yeah.
That'll of course taper off as time goes. But I mean, I just like right now, I mean, I'll be honest, like we're not like making money, we're losing money, right? So we're not profitable or anything. What we're doing is we're just getting a tool out there that gives people freedom, and that's what makes me happy. You know, that's why I built this business. It wasn't to get rich, it was to obviously solve the problems that we've been talking about. I saw a problem, I didn't have a solution for it. I wanted to help. In fact, I was gonna tackle this objective, you know, as my like way to give back to Bitcoin in onboarding people. So I just wanted to go around and be like a Bitcoin evangelist to onboard people. But I kept running into these problems with onboarding people with these wallets that were, you know, the best ones were all centralized and all had custody, right? You had to ask these people for permission. They monitored or could surveil your data. They could sell your data. You know, it's just all really bad stuff. And I never felt comfortable recommending that to people. And during the time when I started building Mana, the self-custodial options existed. And don't let me like degrade or demean anything that these companies have done, because they're great tools, but I also had problems with them, mostly from like the learning curve, right? The barriers to entry were just a little bit higher than I could really get people to wrap their minds around. So, and they have improved. And now I think there are a lot of really great Bitcoin wallets, that work very similarly to Mana. The environment was just a lot different, back then. So, that's kind of why I built Mana, was because I needed a solution that didn't exist at the time. And so again, my excitement, enthusiasm around the growth isn't about, you know, fantastic wealth or whatever. It's about spreading freedom.
Yeah.
So
you're not losing money. You're investing in your freedom maximalism.
Right. It goes back to
the really awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, like we were talking about earlier, you know, it's selfish because I have this world, you know, fantasy world that I want to live in.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm investing into. Yeah. Right. And I say fantasy in the sense that like people might think that I'm thinking that that's never going to happen. I'm doing everything I can to make sure it does. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a fantasy, but it's one that I think we have a shot at.
Yeah. This wallet, and this will sound like an advertisement for me, but I love the product. I was there at the meeting when you introduced it at the KC Bitcoiners meetup about a month or two ago. And in your talk, you said, oh, it takes 2 minutes to set up. It took me about 30 seconds. And it did not take a full minute for me to get a Bitcoin wallet. There's no phone number. There's no email address. I didn't have to give my name. I don't have to do anything in order to download it and create a wallet and be able to have a point of sale system, be able to have self-custody of my Bitcoin, have encrypted anonymous messaging, a Bitcoin map with...
I love that map. That's really cool. Yeah.
And I think shout
out to BTC map.
Yeah.
I think there's a fifth feature on there as well that I'm not saying.
Well, there are. I mean, let me see. As far as like features,
I thought there was five big things, but maybe I'm missing.
I think you hit all the negative ones.
I get the
There are obviously like lots of really small quality of life things in Mana, like being able to receive to a Lightning address.
Yeah,
which is fairly rare with self-custody solutions because it's difficult. Breeze actually did a lot of the pathfinding in this area, so shout out to them. And you were talking about Breeze earlier. I was actually in Vegas on a panel with Mr. Scheinfeld for Breeze. So we were actually talking, our topic was from capital to currency. That was the name of the
talk.
But anyway, so yeah, I'm very familiar with the team over there. They do a really good job, and they're probably one of the groups of people that I'd say we wouldn't have been able to do what we did without them. We both were building kind of a very similar solution at the same time. They may have been a little bit earlier than we were, but we kind of both came to the same conclusion at a very similar time. They released or they had this development kit, Nodeless is what they call it, and it's great. We had already kind of built all of our stack out by the time they were perfecting that. And so we didn't build on the Nodeless SDK. In hindsight, it would have been kind of cool if we did. And we may, you know, be able to use some of that open SDK at some point in the future too, which would be nice. But yeah, it's again, we came to a lot of the same conclusions, which was really cool to see, especially as it pertains to like interacting with people, like sending and receiving payments, because up to that point, you know, obviously, you know, started to get really popular with all of Satoshi and some of these other tools out there where you can push a payment to somebody's Lightning address. So you had like Nostr and stuff that were getting really popular around the time, and you could just zap people sats, right? So, but before that, especially as it pertains to self-custody wallets, it was very difficult, to say the least, to do it in like a kind of plug and play type of a solution. You know, so there's a lot of Lightning wallets out there that don't have this ability, and it is just simply because it's pretty difficult, and there's a lot of complexity that goes on a infrastructure and development and software side that needs to happen in order to make this take place. And again, I just want to point out the fact that Breeze probably was more crucial, pivotal to figuring that out than anybody. So they have a great product, and I would be remiss if I didn't, you know, mention how much work they've done on that. So
is there anything like we came to know Ivan because the first five episodes we did were on Jason Lowry's software thesis, and Ivan reached out to us. He wanted to talk about it. And the man is a literal force of nature with Bitcoin. I think he has single-handedly made Bulgaria a hotspot around the world for Bitcoin. And there's a movie that's being made where he plays a huge role, that kind of explaining how he has been really boots on the ground there.
I heard that movie has some good music in it too.
I am doing a theme song for the movie. I kind of talked about that.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
It's really fantastic. I think one of the things that I want to point out is that you're talking about a competitor in a very kind way. And that's one of that's the thing that brought me, that was my like lightning spark moment about Bitcoin, was that it makes things collaborative, was that I can put out a song and you can take that song and you could add rap lyrics to it. And then you can get the split payments on it. And we can both grow and we can both benefit from that. There's nobody in between it. I want to go back more to I don't want to say conspiratorial because I know where the term conspiracy comes from, thanks to Bitcoin and going down all those rabbit holes. But stable coins are merely a bait and switch in order to hook the world on surveillable
and confiscatable and controllable central bank digital currencies. That is something that I have had something itching at me a little bit that just didn't seem quite right. And I just watched a presentation that Michael Saylor gave at the Middle Eastern Bitcoin conference. Mm-hmm. And he's laying out the plan that Strategy holds the Bitcoin, they hold the capital. And if you're a giant bank, maybe a central bank, then you buy the Stretch and you put it in there and you put your currency with it. And then you put a buffer on top of that in order to keep it at par so that then you can create your currency. This is taking the capital to currency. You were on a panel called Capital to Currency. Yeah. So there's that. And then there's also the aspect of 21, which just debuted on the NASDAQ, on Dow Jones. It's backed by Cantor Fitzgerald. It has all kinds of ties to the government with Bo Hines being part of Tether. And the current administration seems to have a bit of a hankering for nationalizing companies by giving them opportunity to participate with the government. Do you think it's that obvious? I think in retrospect, we look at some of these things that are psychological operations and we look in the rear view and we're like, man, they were telling us what they were doing the whole time. And they were blatant about it. And we just didn't see it and we weren't paying attention. But do you think it's that obvious? Is it going to be that 21 is the vehicle through which the United States government offloads their debt into the cloud through Tether, globalizes it, and pushes it out of the books of the world, and then rolls it back into a CBDC? Is this kind of where you're going? Is this what you're building against? And do you see, instead of knowing that the monster is somewhere behind the fog, are you now starting to see that monster up close? Is this what it is, do you think?
Yes, I think that's actually a good way to put it, because it's easy for me to say, people just need to open their eyes. It's, it is obvious to me. It may not be obvious to everybody. I think that, at times I'm insensitive and think people should be able to see these things. I've been personally talking about this for many years. But as far as it being closer right up in front of our faces, that's kind of part of what motivated me to actually get into action with building what I have also sometimes referred to as an anti-CBDC. So MANA is an anti-CBDC. That is what it is. That is essentially the underlying principle of what is guiding how we are building and developing at MANA, right? We are giving somebody an alternative to the system that we know is coming. It may be a while before it comes to the U.S. I hope it's a very long while. I have no idea how long it's going to take for it to be on our doorstep. What I do feel confident in saying is that it's going to spread, on planet Earth. From this point forward, there's going to be more CBDCs on Earth in 10 years. In 10 years from then, there's going to be more. And I think that eventually it does come to the U.S., whether that's relatively soon or not. I don't know. Just because I think that I saw these things, maybe it's because some people might refer to me as, neurodivergent. Other people might call me a Tylenol American, high functioning autism. Yeah. I don't know. Whatever label you want to put on me. I see through a lot of the facade pretty easily, or at least I convince myself I do to make me feel better about myself sometimes. But I've been pointing out things specifically about Tether for a while, and I don't want to spend too much time on this because I will say I do at my core at this point believe that the team behind Tether has good intentions. That's what I currently believe. Mm-hmm. I thought other things in the past, But I've come to the conclusion, based off of my observation of how they've conducted themselves and everything, I think they are just driven. And I think they actually believe that it is a core component of ushering in hyper-Bitcoinization. Okay. However, I just obviously I have a different conclusion than they do. I think that every step, every dollar, every investment into stablecoins, which obviously tethers the 900-pound gorilla, so we can almost, you know, consider them, you know, synonymous. Every step into Tether is not a step toward Bitcoin, in my opinion. Now, obviously, there's arguments to this. Alan Farrington has a piece where he makes a case for this. I don't think that it's case closed. Are you guys familiar with Alan Farrington?
Familiar with, like, Bitcoin is Venus is his book, but we haven't looked at that one yet. I got on my bookshelf. We haven't read it yet. So
I think he had, it's been a while since I've read it, but I think he has like a disclaimer at some point where he's like, this is not a real article. This is just like some bots on paper kind of thing. But it is, it's still, I mean, he's a genius. It's very well done.
Very much so.
So I would, if you're interested in the stablecoin topic, it's definitely worth reading. Maybe I'll send it to you guys. And if anyone else wants to
look
at it, maybe you can share a link. But very good. Guy Swan also did a piece on it too. Nice. So if you read it, it's easily digestible if you're a listener. So where am I going with all this? I think that stablecoins are a detractor from the future that I want to try to build. And so I have just personally, I mean, if anybody's followed me on X for any lengthy period of time, I probably don't go more than a month. I don't know if that's accurate, but I would say on average, I probably post something negative about stablecoins at least once a month. In fact, I very regularly tweet a very specific set of characters that doesn't deviate. And it just says, Tether is a scam.
Fairly straightforward. So
on this podcast, Jeff Booth called, he said, we need to call things by what they are instead of by what people want us to call them. Stable coins are guaranteed loss coins. They do not keep stable value. They guarantee that you lose value. I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree. And the problem is it's very tasty. It's very easily consumed.
Yeah.
Because people can just go, oh, well, here's my dollars. Here's my dollars in stable coins.
Yeah.
I mean, the argument for them is like they serve a purpose perhaps as a historical bridge or as a necessary stopping point onto a better currency in places like Argentina and in Africa. That, I mean, Gladstein in his piece in the Journal of Democracy, I mean, the stablecoin usage is very big amongst the dissidents and people that,
for cross-border remittances.
Yeah, and stuff like that. So it has a use case that it's currently serving. But as far as your point, though, I mean, it's not historically where we want to go. It's not the trend we want to see.
I think what it ultimately does is it prolongs the
inevitable.
Yeah, it prolongs the inevitable. But what I have a problem with mostly is that it prolongs the fiat central bank fractional reserve regime.
Yeah, for sure it does.
Right.
Yeah,
it keeps central banking alive.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It does this through its purchase of government debt.
Yep.
And it's just another form of the same drug that we're all addicted to. And one of the points that I made at the summit that you were at is that stablecoins, where's it going with this?
We're at the summit. You're speaking on stage. You're making a point about stablecoins.
Stablecoins are just a hyperized version. It's instead of snort cocaine, you're shooting it in your veins now.
If you ever need a colorful analogy,
all right. Well, we might need to come back.
We can, and please do. Please do come back to that.
Because
this is so much fun.
Yeah,
we've got to do more.
I just want to know who Adam is. I'm trying to piece together your biography because I'm kind of left in the military, and then I got into COVID, and then now you have the Mana wallet. And from my perspective of just always having a dirty fiat job, never doing anything entrepreneurial, to someone to do something like that just seems like what are you just, a Renaissance man? Like, where'd you come up? Where did the technical capacity to do this come from? Where did the internal reserves, like, how did you do this?
Well, first of all, I want to address something that I think is really important and that people don't hear enough. And that is, you know, these fiat jobs, like working in the fiat mines, people always tend to have this mindset of like, I need to get into working in Bitcoin. And I push back on that, like hardcore. I think that the best thing that you can do is provide a service or a product, like provide your human capital to the world in the best way you can and save in Bitcoin. If you can accept the payment in Bitcoin directly, that's not possible for everybody, but at a minimum, just go buy Bitcoin, right? That is how that you're the most efficient use of your human capital in terms of moving us toward, you know, Bitcoin standard. If you want to call it that.
Yeah.
I think that is the most efficient use of your energy is to do what you're good at. Use the systems that are in place already. Like, you don't have to recreate the wheel. Like, almost literally speaking, you know, going and leaving something that you already have that's established,
right,
and trying to do something in Bitcoin because you think you're going to push the needle faster, you're not. What's really going to push the needle is you doing something in the real world that is making you a lot of money. And you're literally just a massive siphon from, you know, fiat into Bitcoin. That is going to be much more effective than, you know, trying to go get hired at some Bitcoin company, yeah, where they're just, you're a problem looking for a solution.
But that being said, though, you did make the Mana wallet. So,
yeah.
So having put that asterisk there, like, right. I mean, it seems like such a, I guess I don't know where your education was. You were a business major. It seems like a technical enterprise. Say someone is a foolhardy person and they do want to do something similar to what you did. Did you just acquire talents? You just learn by yourself on your own what you need to do to get this going, or how did this happen?
Yeah, let me go kind of chronologically because this might help build into what became Mana. So in 2017, I told you about this period where I'm reading this article. I had this epiphany, proof of work. It was literally in that same moment that I realized one of the next thing I wanted to do. And that was, I wanted to build a computer that people could put in their house and they just plug it in and turn it on and it starts mining for them.
Beautiful.
In this exact moment, of course, it was Ethereum, which I'm glad, you know, changed direction at some point.
But, yeah.
So while I was on my deployment, I started building my plans for a business that I built called Hands Free Bitcoin. And that's literally what it was. We built miners. We built the hardware. So we put all the hardware together. We had, you know, custom power supplies. We did some custom circuitry. We had our own custom case and some of our own custom components so that all you had to do was pull it out of the box and flip a switch and it starts mining Bitcoin for you. We also did the software, of course, and then custom tuning firmware to make it like a palatable consumer grade product. You buy this product, you run it in your home, and it just works and it doesn't annoy the heck out of your wife, right? It's girlfriend friendly. I think I was on a podcast or somebody said that. So this started in 2017. The business is still going today. We're not selling any new product, but we're servicing existing customers still to this day. But ultimately, economies of scale and difficulty adjustment got the best of us. And so we're kind of sunsetting that business. But it was a really cool journey for me. One, it was, you know, profitable. So it allowed me to financially position myself to do what I'm doing now with Mana. So that's how I'm funding Mana. I don't have to go to a VC and, you know, give them my wrist to chain up and, you know, to tow me around and tell me what to do and, you know, conform to their wishes, which I have also talked a lot about because I see a lot of that in the space, especially in Bitcoin. And without naming any names, I will just say, you know, there are only a very small handful of people in the Bitcoin space where everybody knows when you run out of funding, this is who you go to. And again, I think it's a dangerous path. And so at this point, in this moment, you know, Mana's never taken any venture capital investment. We've taken no donations. It's literally been just a labor of love and something that, you know, that I've, you know, invested myself into. So if you, you know, maybe if you agree with me, if you like the way that I think, then maybe Mana is cool from an idealistic perspective for you. If you don't like the way I think, then Mana might not be for you, because I think Mana is very closely aligned with the way that I believe. This is, you know, kind of building into this. The hands-free Bitcoin is where I got a lot of the skills to do what I've done with Mana.
So, and you got those, again, just on your own, researching, talking to people, I suppose, and putting it all together in your mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. And finding the right people. I found it. I don't know how deep you want to go into this, but I found a developer to help me with the coding for hands-free Bitcoin. So there was a lot of... Actually, it was a handful of people over the period of a few years, but I figured out how to find people to help me do what I needed to do. And so that networking led to, you know, being able to find the people that now I need to work with to help with Mana. So I'm not the only one working on Mana. I have a very good software engineer that has done most of the code. He's great. So pretty much everything on the back end is him. We also have another, he's a product, lead product manager, platforms manager. And he helps with kind of basically, I mean, there's three of us, so yeah, we all cool. do everything,
mm-hmm.
Right now. So it's a really small team. It's really exciting because, you know, we get to do exactly what we want to do and nobody can tell us not to.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know how close, if you follow Mana on X or not, but we put out like some stuff that most people probably wouldn't say or do. We're religious. You know, we say things from a religious
perspective. It's called Mana.
Yeah, it's called Mana. I mean, we don't all have the same faith either,
yeah.
Right? So it's just, it's part of our brand. It's part of what I think, I want to glorify God because I believe that he's gotten us to this point, and it's kind of my way to incorporate, that message into what I do. So I, can tell people about Bitcoin and the saving powers of Bitcoin, but it also gives me an opportunity to tell people about Christ.
The saving power of Christ.
Yeah. See,
there you go.
Christ. Yeah. So
I like it.
Yeah.
Together.
And I get to do that because nobody can tell me not to. And if I had, I'm not saying that other people don't have that ability to speak their own mind, but going back to like the story of me almost losing my job, it's because of Bitcoin that I'm able to do that. It's because I have my own self-sovereignty. I have my own agency, right? Without my own agency, I can't do or say whatever I want to say. And so I'm very outspoken on X, and I have a lot of people that point that out to me, and I'm like, man, I wish I could say half the things that you say to people. And I'm like, well, why don't you? Like, well, I'd lose my job, man. I'm like, well, Bitcoin's FU money, right? Like, whatever. You can't freeze my bank account. You want to fire me? See ya.
Yeah.
That's kind of where I am, from an ideological perspective and how I built into Mana from where I learned, what I learned with my others.
Yeah.
Business.
Is there future projects that you got kind of machinating in the back
I do.
Yeah.
just talking to my wife. I have everything from I think this is a cool idea to like, I have ideas that I'm not going to talk
right.
to you guys about today that would absolutely change the world fundamentally as we know it. So, but they're very lofty goals and it would take a lot, but I think that, if I ever get really, really, really stupid rich, I'm going to do this.
You okay?
Yeah.
You're not afraid to go into jail, the samurai wall, guys. I've seen you on X supporting Keon Rodriguez and I forget the other
Bill.
Guy's name. Bill. Builders of open source software. Is that something that you've had to take into account building Mana? Thinking
every step along
I could go to jail. Yeah.
There's actually a lot that I could unpack here. When I first started building Mana, I'll just be like super open and transparent with you guys here. I had like this desire, like I knew like in my heart, like this is what I wanted to do, but I prayed about it and felt like God was telling me it's not time. And I was kind of frustrated about that. I was like, okay, whatever. So I just kind of like let it simmer. and it kept coming back up. I'm like, man, there's something that I need to build and it doesn't exist. Like, I just need to do this. And I kept, again, coming back to the point where I felt like I was being led not to at that time. Like, just wait. Like, God was just telling me, just hold on and wait. And then, I don't know why this was the day that things changed, but I was following, a bunch of my friends, on X were working for Swan and they just had a massive layoff.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, this kind of goes back to some of the Tether stuff that we kind of touched on. We don't need to get into that, but it is just a little bit of irony. If you, want to dive into that lore, that's an interesting rabbit hole to go down. But, so I remember seeing that news, and that was, I was sitting in a car dealership getting my car serviced, oil change. And, that's where I had this moment where I just felt like that was the switch. And I felt like it was just placed on my heart where God was just saying, go.
Nice.
Now's the time. It's time to go. And I'm like freaking out because this is the samurai stuff, the tornado cash stuff. This was all like mainstream news. I mean,
right. Yeah.
At this point, like everybody's talking about it. And things are really kind of scary. And Choke Point 2.0 was still alive and well. And so we have people facing, you know, serious charges. We have people getting, you know, cut off from the financial system. And basically turned into criminals, right? And so I'm thinking about all this. And then just over the course of the next few months, it was like a very strong shift of events. So we had a lot of positive messaging coming out of DC and, you know, essentially our bureaucrats telling us that they're not going to be, you know, that they're going to be treating these things more fairly, you know, more less severely, or like, I can't forget exactly which messages were coming out, but there were a series of positive things that were coming out regarding, you know, more favorable for Bitcoin developers. Anyways, just a bunch of these different series of events that happened. And then the elections were coming up and then Trump got elected. And like, I was like, okay, this is like perfect timing because all the other wallets have just got kicked out of the country, basically. They all just left. They ran away. And the U.S. is in desperate need of something to use because we didn't have it. Like, even if you wanted to use Wallet of Satoshi, it was IP blocked. So, as well as Phoenix, right?
Really?
Yeah. So they were not available in the U.S. And then Mutiny. You guys remember in Mutiny? I think Matt O'Dell was involved. Remember Matt O'Dell?
Yeah.
I don't know how involved he was. I heard from him, and Mutiny had just announced that they're closing their doors. And so there was like, during this time frame, there was like nothing. And so I was like, okay, this is like firing in all cylinders. Let's just go. So I built it. I went hard and then released it in like 8 months or so. So from concept to on the Apple App Store and Google Play Store in 8 months, which is pretty fast. For a functional working product. Now, it's been an iterative process. It's come a long way since then, but, you know, it was pretty quickly. We were just moving really fast because, you know, we saw things changing and wanted to take advantage of the opportunity. But the question about, you know, where I stood with what I was thinking about this whole process is, you know, I'm still like very cautious about what I feel like I can say. There's so much that I want to be able to say about Mana that I have reservations to even talk about. These things aren't illegal to say. These things are constitutionally protected. They're you know, ethical, right? I think that they're beneficial for humanity, and I just can't talk about them like I want to. I could, but there's a line, you know.
Risk being a target.
I risk being a target.
Tall blade of chaos.
I think I'm going to learn what I can from the samurai case. And
it's pretty incredible. Like, private what's up message is taken out of context in that case and used to build the criminal conspiracy case that he says Bitcoin is for money laundering or something like that, as part of a private exchange he's having with somebody, as part of a continuum of the exchange, like this is a part, like one analogy he gives, and then it's used to build a criminal conspiracy case. That's insane. And now it's chilling your First Amendment right to say what you would otherwise say.
I was actually talking about this on Bitcoin Today Space on X this last week, and I was just like telling everybody kind of like where my thoughts are as a developer, because now I'm questioning like how much I even want to invest in building this business and this technology in the United States, right? This technology that, you know, helps move freedom forward. It helps, you know, build Bitcoin innovation, which supposedly the administration is for. And now I'm taking these things into question. I'm a lot more cautious about these things. So I guess the question is, you know, do we really want the Bitcoin development to happen in the US? And if that's the case, you know, we should probably consider some of the implications of things like the Samurai case and how it affects how other developers are looking at this. So we saw the opposite happen. So obviously when the election happened, Trump got elected, he established his cabinet, and they started coming out with all of this, you know, very positive stuff. We had Dainex come back to the U.S. We had Wallace Satoshi come back. And so there was a very clear message that, hey, we're not going to, you know, criminalize this activity. And then the sentencing, you know, came through with the plea deal, mm-hmm. the Samurai. And then we had the sentencing with Fernando Cash. Yeah, so they got obviously charged as well. So all that to say, I think, you know, where I stand now is I am cautiously optimistic about the future of Mana. I am gonna keep building it, unless, you know, there's some very clear reason or legal reason why I can't. You know, I'm never going to break the law. I will always build things in accordance to the law. Mana is fully self-custodial. We're not a money transmitter. We never touch anybody's user funds. We never custody anybody's funds. We don't store any private data. Everything is all local. So it's just free software you can put on your phone.
Yeah.
But again, that's sometimes not enough, as we're seeing with the Samurai case. You know, it doesn't appear to me that they really did anything egregiously wrong. Again, messages taken out of context is kind of where they got them, which is, I mean, that is a very disgraceful justice system.
Yeah. So, it sounds like you've never got a tap on the shoulder, or you've never felt that you were being monitored or that you were being looked at by any regulator or agent or anything like that. You've never felt that type of presence, though.
I won't go into details. I thought there was at one point. I've changed my mind. So at this point, the answer is no. I don't think that there is anybody breathing down my neck at this point. I'm doing things completely in the open. Mm-hmm. I'm hiding nothing. Everything, like, you know, my name is attached to it. You know, I've literally, you know, my business address, everything is like kosher. Like, I have a registered business, again, open software, like, we're using open source tools.
Yeah.
There's nothing that we're hiding. And we're not breaking any laws. So the only thing there is like making sure we don't say the wrong thing, which is really kind of sad.
Yeah, as it is very much so.
I should have the right to say whatever I want to say. And this all, in my opinion, as I've said this before, I think this really all comes down to the fact that we have built a series of laws and legislation on top of an unconstitutional piece of legislation called the Bank Secrecy Act of 1970. Yeah. So we established the BSA of 1970, and then we built all of these laws and in case law around the BSA. And so we have the KYC and AML laws, which are part of that as well. And that's the fundamental problem. In my opinion, that's kind of where this all seeds from, is because, they, you know, said things that, the Samurai folks, you know, said things that potentially implicated them as conspiracy, as an unlicensed money transmitter, right? To operate as an unlicensed money transmitter. I think that's what the charge they pled guilty to, if I'm not mistaken.
Some sort of conspiracy charge. So it wouldn't surprise me if that was the...
I thought it was I thought it was related to money transmission. Was one of the charges brought against them. I don't know if that's the one that they stuck with. Anyway, but my point still stands that, you know, even if you're not transmitting money, you know, how can you charge somebody for unlicensed money transmission, you know, if they're not actually transmitting any money? But it goes back to the fact that this is all built on a series of unconstitutional laws, which are built on an unconstitutional piece of legislation called the PSA. So my message is, we need to repeal the PSA. It does not belong in our country.
That was Natalie Smolensky's big ask too on Twitter, when she, like, one thing the new administration should change. And in her introduction to the Satoshi papers, she writes, like, the Bank Secrecy Act is her big bete noir, that she calls it the banker's revolution, when you have all this legislation in the 1970s, creeping authoritarianism. And yeah, and I think that you're absolutely right that it's, I mean, you're just a living example of your speech being chilled. It's just to see that in person, to know that you can't say what you want to say, what you might want to say in this country, that's incredible. I mean, and it is because of these unconstitutional laws, and also just that conspiracy is such a vague criminal. You can build a conspiracy case with very little, like not even the act itself, but conspiring to do the act.
And as Kennedy said it himself, like it's the only thing that they could get them on, that they didn't have to bring a victim. Everything else,
true victimless crimes. Yeah.
But this is the one charge that did not require a victim.
Yeah.
My wife and I, well, my wife was actually asking me about this literally as I was walking out the door to come see you guys. She's
yeah.
Like, so are you going to go to jail? Obviously, I've been watching a lot of the Keone podcasts and stuff, and trying to do my best to spread the message about his case, and hopefully get the message.
Yeah, there's a petition on, like, what the petition website is, change.org or something like that, to sign. So
yeah, I've signed it. If you guys haven't signed it, I would encourage you to at least consider doing it. You do have to dox yourself, I think, to do it, but I think it, in this case, for me, it was worth it. So, but my wife was asking me about it. She's like, Are you gonna go to jail? Or she said something to the effect like, are you gonna go to jail like Paul from the Bible? And I was like, well, I don't know. If they try to do the same thing to me, at least a whole lot more people are gonna hear about Jesus, because I'm not gonna shut up about it. So there's my protection there.
I feel like you wouldn't go to jail. I feel like you would be a prisoner of conscience. I feel like you would. I mean, you looked down the barrel to lose your job and everything. I think that, I don't know. Yeah. I'm not saying you would go to jail. I'm saying that if the situation arose, I don't see you standing back.
You know, for the sake of my kids, though.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know. That's would be my determining.
Yeah. 100%.
Whatever is in their best interest, I'm going to make sure I do.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. I got one more. So you've got a vision, and you've been moving from this inflection point in 2017 towards that vision that seems to have been the motivation and the wellspring for you to first create miners and now create this incredible product that's more than just a wallet. It's a communication, and it's a point of sale system, and it's an accounting of who can you do business with. Spit out your Bitcoin shibboleths as you walk along the path of life. And I think that you have a vision for where we go. And I just kind of wanted to hear, because I'm a songwriter, I'm a storyteller. I love to hear the vivid landscapes that people can paint with their words and what they see in their mind. Where do you think we go in the next 10 years? Like, where, and it can be with anything. It can be geopolitical, it can be war, it can be the authoritarianism issue, it can be, is there a great man that arises? Is there, you know, does the fourth turning happen and we all just end up blown to bits? What's the future that you see coming?
I think that that's going to be, well, there's a lot of different forces moving at high velocities in all different directions. So it's really hard for me to, like, guess. And it's just like, you know, if you tried to ask me, you know, what the price of Bitcoin is going to be in, you know, 10 months, I'd probably have to be just clueless. But also there's a lot of factors that I think I do see kind of converging toward certain directions. And there's a lot of different ways people like to quantify it. One of the philosophies of thought is like the turnings, right? You've got the fourth turning type of philosophy. And I think there's a lot of credibility to that. I think that explains a lot of what we're seeing. And I align with that theory quite a bit, that I think that we are, quote unquote, in a fourth turning. And we're seeing a lot of those same things. I mean, historically, there's a lot of these, obviously, a very common phrase is history doesn't repeat, but it often rhymes. And that's just another way to look at, you know, the fact that we have these events that kind of these cyclical events throughout our history. And we're at a pretty big inflection point in a lot of different types of cycles. You know, we have, you know, different business cycles. We have political cycles. We have, you know, fourth turning type cycles, these ideological cycles. A lot of these are kind of converging right now. And at the center of this is Bitcoin. And I think that's really cool because as Bitcoiners, we get a front row seat, but it is also, there's a lot at stake. There's a lot on the line. And, you know, if I had to say, like, where are we going to be at in 10 years? I think it's going to be up to us right today. What we do today, I think we actually, as Bitcoiners, and again, back to the point where I think Bitcoin's really at the heart of a lot of what's going to happen for the next 10 years. If we can build a system around ourselves, because, you know, people will say, yeah, well, TikTok next block, Bitcoin's never going to stop working. Obviously, you know, we know that. But, and I've also said it this way, like, you can't ban Bitcoin, but you can ban yourself from Bitcoin, you know, as geopolitically speaking. So Bitcoin's going to be okay, but Bitcoiners are what really matters. It's the Bitcoiners. It's what the system we have for us and the amount of freedom that we have in 10 years. You know, so that's why I am so passionate about teaching people how important it is to use Bitcoin as your money, buy, sell, you know, any type of transaction, payroll, you know, whatever. Anytime you're touching money, it ought to be Bitcoin, because this is what moves us closer to the freedom that we want in 10 years. And takes power away from those that are incentivized to steal more from us. And so I'm optimistic. I think we have a very good shot at, with the amount of freedom that we have in the United States, we do still have some semblance of fair law and, you know, constitution that people actually still believe in. I believe in this constitution and I swore an oath to protect and defend it. And I will until probably the day I die, unless it conflicted with something else that I believed in more, right? But I think the American Constitution is very unique. I think it is something that is worth, you know, dying to protect. So that's where I stand on things. I think that because we have these beliefs in our country, I think we actually have a good chance to do something. I think that every other nation, maybe not every other nation, but at least almost all of them, they're all handicapped because fundamentally, and this is my personal belief, it's fundamentally because they don't have the right to the Second Amendment. They do not have the right to bear arms. And I think it is because we have the right to bear arms, we can keep the government in check. And it's not necessarily that we have to threaten to, civil war or anything like that, but it is there. Right. That is a very rare and unlikely possibility, but it is there. And what a lot of people probably don't even remember, we talked about the Canadian trucker protest, mm-hmm. the summit. And there was this freedom convoy that happened, and the Canadian government was shutting people's bank accounts down, stealing their money, you know, and doing all these terrible things. And the truckers weren't giving up. And it wasn't very popular news, but there was a similar movement happening in the United States at the exact same time.
Yep.
Were you guys in Kansas Texas. City?
It was featured. I was not. No,
it was featured on. Have you ever seen the YouTube channel Channel 5 News? They did a. They,
I don't
a,
know.
Yeah, it's a. I forget the guy's name, but he did a whole episode on it. It was big. I mean, it was not 50 guys.
So describe this though.
It was significant.
Right. So I don't know all the details. I'll tell you what I know from my perspective. I'm close to a major highway that runs through the state of Kansas, which is like the heart of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so we had you know, thousands of trucks going past where I live.
Zero news coverage.
Zero news coverage, right? And so they were, guess where they were all headed? Washington, D.C. They were literally in their trucks halfway across the country. And you know what happened? Canada gave up on the trucker protest. They you know, they're like, all right, fine. You know, just we're good. We're done. Get them out of here. We'll appease you in the near term. And so they basically kind of, they ended that and gave up because of the United States. And what it really came down to is that all of these truckers, they were all, you know, essentially potentially armed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right. So they didn't have that luxury in Canada. In the United States, you're mm-hmm. legally allowed to arm yourself. And so they didn't want this escalating into a physical conflict with, you know, bullets, right? And so not to say that that was guaranteed to happen, but again, it came down to the fact that it was a possibility, and you don't want like really angry Americans with a lot of guns in one location that are very passionate, and then you start taking away their freedoms that the Constitution says you can kill people if they do, you know? So I think that is ultimately, in my mind, a big reason for what keeps the whole world in check is the Americans have the ability to keep our own government in check to some degree. Now, in practice, that doesn't always.
Yeah. Yeah. The base layer is kinetic power. I mean, it comes down to proof of work. Yeah. I mean,
the second.
Yeah.
I remembered what I was going to say, just in case anybody was like, oh man, he was on, you know, he needed to finish his thought. I was talking at the summit about Tether and how it is basically the infrastructure portion of a CBDC.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's all I was going to say is a Tether is the infrastructure. It is the money component of a CBDC. So you kind of have stable coins plus digital ID.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember
under the control of a government. Mm-hmm. That is a CBDC.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was what I was going
to. That ties it together very nicely. Yeah. The fact of tying the identity to it definitely turns it up a notch into a CBDC. Yeah.
Cool.
Well, that's all I got, man.
I'll tell you what, this has been absolutely fantastic. I really can't thank you enough. This is wonderful.
Well,
Adam Smeka, you're a father, you're a Christian, you're an entrepreneur. We thank you for your product. We thank you for your passion. We thank you for your service. And we thank you for being here and taking the time to come be with us. We want to let you go, and we want to make sure that people know where to follow you on X and for Mana Wallet. And then anything you want to say going out, the floor is yours.
Sure. First of all, thank you so much. This was a pleasure. It was really fun. Looks like you guys actually put quite a bit of work into this setup today. So
it's surprising when you watch it, but we do put work into it.
But no, it's an honor. Thank you for so many kind words. In a way, makes it all worth it. So we'll really appreciate that. I'm on X at Adam Smeka, just my name. And then if you're interested in the Bitcoin wallet stuff, it's at Mana Bitcoin. Just one word, at Mana Bitcoin, two N's on Mana. So
right on. Yeah. Best follow you'll find all day, man. Exciting stuff on X. Always fun to read your stuff. So
I will definitely admit.
You're a salty little.
I am entertaining. You know, no humility.
If nothing else, yeah.
If nothing else, I'm entertaining.
Yeah.
All right.
Right on.
We're gonna put the lid on this one.
Yeah. Cut it.